keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the Inquiry Sessions.
My name is Alastair Harding, and today on the Inquiry Sessions, I have with me Danish scientific researcher Peter Gercher. During the COVID pandemic, Peter was one of the few fearless scientific researchers who shined a light on the so-called lab leak theory and other aspects of the pandemic that the World Health Organization, governments, and the media not only ignored, but actively suppressed and censored. The lab leak story is especially bewildering, that the media won't talk about it, and that our governments won't step up to stop it happening again. Because as you'll hear from Peter, this isn't the first time a lab leak has caused countless deaths. For those of us who want to hear clear explanations of what the media don't tell us about what went on during the COVID years, Peter's voice is a credible and authoritative one that not only knows how to read and explain the research, but also to shine a light on the inner workings of the medical and scientific establishment. Peter joins us today from his home in Denmark to help us review the bigger global picture of the COVID years for our very own Reality Check Radio COVID Inquiry. So Peter, welcome to the Inquiry Sessions.
Thank you.
I'd like to briefly start with your story, just so our listeners understand who they're listening to, because it's almost as if you were built to be here at this time in history. You've spent a career in research and science. You're one of the founders of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is touted by many as the gold standard of scientific review. And then you were kicked out of Cochrane. And because of that, you've suffered in the media for that. But you've stayed very productive and you've written an incredible amount of books and articles, and one of which is about how the pharma industry is basically organized crime. So you're not backing down. You believe passionately in scientific research, and you appear to be driven entirely by a search for the truth. Is that a good description? Is that a description you'd agree with?
That's correct. And I have never thought about the consequences. I'm a scientist, so I tell people what I see, even though it may have huge consequences for myself. And my expulsion from Cochrane has nothing to do with any wrongdoing on my part. It was mainly because I'm an ardent critic of psychiatry and psychiatric drugs. So people organized to have me expelled in order to protect their guilt interest while they continue harming our populations to an incredible extent with psychiatric drugs. So that was the reason I was expelled after a horrible show trial like in Soviet Union and still in Russia now today. And I have written two books about this show trial, and we are making a documentary film about it as well with one of the best Danish filmmakers. So that's the short version of what happened.
You do seem to be a man who's just dedicated to making sure, to standing up and speaking truth to power. In that vein, there were two particular stories that you wrote during the COVID pandemic that I read on the Brownstone Institute website. And those two are ones that I'd particularly like to talk about today. One is about the origins of COVID. The other one is about the response that was rolled out around the world, especially the lockdowns in respect to Sweden in particular. But to begin with, let's talk about the origins of COVID. Where did it come from? Because for a long time, this has been considered a conspiracy theory to talk about it. But now as the dust is settling, it's as if we're allowed to talk about it again. And what's your opinion? Where did it come from?
Well, it clearly came from Wuhan in China. And I find it highly likely that it was a lab leak, because the security level at the lab, which should have been the highest, was not higher than in a U.S. dentist office. So this was criticized before the pandemic. And the molecular composition of the virus suggests pretty strongly that it was manufactured at the Wuhan laboratory, because they experimented with making viruses more dangerous. This is well known, and I have studied it in quite some detail also because I have a background in infectious diseases, so I was interested in this. So I have read a lot about it, and there's no doubt in my mind that this is one of the biggest conspiracies in modern times, that because America was involved with this dangerous gain of function research, making innocent viruses dangerous, and they provided funding to Wuhan, they were interested in joining the Chinese state in covering up for the whole thing, because it looked bad for the United States that they were complicit in the deaths of millions of people around the world, including very many Americans. So we now know that the main advisor to four US presidents, Anthony Fauci, he has lied about what he knew, because in the beginning, these people in America, they also thought, like me, that this looks like a manufactured virus that escaped from a lab. But then they changed their explanations totally when they published in Nature Medicine, and there was also a ridiculous article in Lancet where people said it was a conspiracy theory to say that it was a lab leak. This is just so horrible. There is nothing in terms of a conspiracy by just stating the obvious.
And some of the evidence that you talk about in your article about that is that we have now seen emails between the different scientists, between Fauci and Francis Collins, for instance, talking about how they were looking for a quick, swift takedown of any so-called conspiracy theory, or what they were considering to be a conspiracy theory about it, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. These emails have been very illuminating. And when Fauci most recently was questioned in Congress, he said, "I don't remember," many, many, many times. A man of his standing doesn't suffer from such huge memory losses. So he's still trying to play games.
One of the biggest pieces of evidence that, as a layperson, has impressed me is the talk about the furin cleavage site. And I'd like to quote from the article that you wrote. You said, "When the Wuhan Institute put out their first paper about the pandemic virus, they failed to point out that the novel furin cleavage site, despite having had plans to insert this, and also they did insert it in SARS-like viruses in their lab. A molecular biologist from Harvard said that it's as if these scientists proposed putting horns on horses, but when a unicorn shows up in their city a year later, they write a paper describing every part except its horn." It seems to me that this is something that proves that it was made in a lab. Is that the right way to look at this?
Well, I'm a scientist. I don't have opinions. I study the science and then I make conclusions. And science is a lot about probabilities. We rarely have absolute certainty, so we use probabilities. And when I use probabilities, I come to the conclusion that this virus must have been manufactured in Wuhan, just like they manufactured similar viruses earlier, inserting the same furin cleavage site, which was also found in the new virus that has killed so many people. And there is no way that this cleavage site could just have occurred naturally, because that's just so highly unlikely that we can dismiss this possibility. And we have not seen any intermediate steps from these bats that lived in a cage, in a cave, sorry, 1,500 kilometers away from Wuhan, where they collected samples and then they went home and experimented on them. There are no intermediate animal hosts like we saw it for earlier pandemics, like the SARS virus quite some years ago.
Could you explain to me what is a furin cleavage site? What is it that we're talking about there?
It is something that makes the virus more infectious and more likely to kill people.
So they were deliberately trying to make it more transmissible amongst human beings.
Yes, this is what they had done earlier and published articles about. And this seems very strange unless you think that it had to do with possible biological warfare. And now, most recently, people have alerted to the fact that the Chinese military was involved with this dangerous research. I don't know to which extent this has any bearing, but I mean, why would you experiment with creating dangerous viruses? Well, the explanation was that then we might be better prepared if a pandemic comes up, because we would be in a better position to develop vaccines against a dangerous virus, which I think it is not a good explanation. You play with fire in order to be better at extinguishing a fire, but then you actually release a fire that goes over the whole world like a prairie fire and kills a lot of people. I mean, this kind of research, to my mind, should be totally forbidden. And I have argued that the WHO and our governments should make this kind of research illegal because it's far too dangerous and it has never led to anything beneficial.
Why is it continuing then? Because I also read in your article, you mentioned that SARS in 2003 and the H1N1 scare in 1977 were both results of lab leaks as well. And that 1977 outbreak, you mentioned, killed over 700,000 people. So my question is why are we not learning from these mistakes? I just don't understand it as a human being. How this research is still allowed.
I don't get it either. We have seen millions of people dying, and yet, why not ban this research? It was actually banned for a while in the United States, but then there was a loophole, and then it just continued. There was a loophole in the regulations. Why don't we talk about that we never want to be in this situation again?
Does that get talked about?
I have not seen any other than myself. Well, of course, there have been other people who have called for a ban on this dangerous research, but why don't we hear about it in the news, in messages from the WHO? Why are everybody silent about this? I just don't get it. I mean, to kill millions of people through playing Frankenstein, I mean, it's like a huge war, the number of casualties.
Yeah, well, if we're talking about 700,000 people dying from the 1977 H1N1 virus, that is in the realms of some of our more potent genocidal maniacs in history, isn't it?
Oh, yes, but we are talking about millions that were killed by what I call the Chinese virus, because it is a Chinese virus.
Okay, what's the role of medical journals in all of this? And I bring this up because it appears that previously trusted journals like The Lancet were actually a part of this. They published that famous letter, for instance, that downplayed the lab leak. And on that topic, I'd like to quote another line from your story on this, which was on 19 February 2020, a group of virologists and others published a Lancet letter which derailed the debate about the origin of COVID-19. And you said, "This was the darkest moment in science in my lifetime." Why is that? What's the implications of journals participating in this way?
First of all, we knew so much about these viruses and the experiments in Wuhan that had been carried out for a number of years that it was absolutely outrageous to publish an article in Lancet that not only said that this was extremely unlikely, as I remember it, that it was a lab leak, but also called it a conspiracy theory if you believed that it could be a lab leak, the most obvious explanation. I mean, when scientists start using names like that, as a scientist, you should not call an obvious explanation a conspiracy theory. It is so far down towards the moral bottom that I am still so appalled about it, and also appalled that a journal like The Lancet would publish this. They should have rejected it right away on the spot, but they didn't.
Is this still a conspiracy theory, or is this known now? Is this what is the settled story after all the dust has settled on this?
Well, first of all, to call something that is scientifically highly plausible for a conspiracy theory, that does not belong to the realm of science. It belongs to, what do you call it, boulevard journals? What do you call it in English? These, untrustworthy sources. I mean, to come up with this name, conspiracy theory, I mean, it gives me memories that are very dark. What did the Nazis do in Nazi Germany? They talked about a worldwide conspiracy that the Jews were responsible for. They had never been responsible for a worldwide conspiracy, but that's what they used in their propaganda, and then they started killing millions of Jews. I mean, nowadays that scientists can even use this expression instead of having a good scientific debate about a very important public health issue, it's just so appalling.
Okay, so now let's move on to the second part of this interview, which is about the lockdowns. This is about the response. How useful were these lockdowns? And I say that with the memory of our experience here in New Zealand. We went through several lockdowns, and there were parts of the country like Auckland where the lockdowns lasted for several months. We had levels and convoluted traffic light systems and a whole lot of things that didn't really make much sense. So there's not much point in explaining them to you. It was all very confusing. But we were told it was the only way, and we've been told since that it saved countless lives. But did it? Because you have a lot of knowledge about what Sweden did, which was completely the opposite. Can you tell me about what Sweden did and what were their results?
Yes, and I would like to point out that I have interviewed Martin Koldof, who is Swedish but became a professor at Harvard in the United States. He visited me last summer, and I have published a podcast on this in our series called Broken Medical Science. So people can easily find my interview with Koldof. It took an hour, and in my view, this is a fantastic hour because we go through virtually everything that was wrong during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Martin and I have the same view that it was totally wrong from the beginning to think that you can contain a respiratory virus by closing down societies, sending children home from school, and whatever was done. You just can't do that. A respiratory virus will travel around no matter what you do, so you should have dealt with this in a totally different manner. And the Great Barrington Declaration, that has Koldof as one of its three authors, suggested early on that we should not lock down our societies, but we should protect the most vulnerable people, like old people, who are in much greater risk of dying if they become infected. And Sweden then was, I think, the only country in the world that did not lock down. They kept the society open. And also, they did not walk around with these foolish face masks. Science have shown that they don't work, and yet they were mandated everywhere, apart from Sweden, where it was voluntary. So Swedes did not look like bank robbers. They lived as usual. And now it has been shown that Sweden actually fared better than virtually all other countries. They had more mortality in the beginning, and they have admitted that this was because they did not protect their nursing homes sufficiently. They made an error there. So it didn't look good in the beginning. The mortality rate was considerably higher in Sweden than in Norway and Denmark, for example. But then, when you look back at it now, Sweden did better than we did, because what you need to consider is that when you lock down societies, it has a cost, also in terms of lives. A US cardiologist whom I know, Harlan Krumholz, he stated during the pandemic that they were missing a lot of the patients they usually saw, patients with pain in the chest that could be a myocardial infarction, a heart attack. They were missing patients who might have a stroke. And we have good treatments that can save the lives of many of these people, but they were afraid of getting COVID if they went to hospital, so they stayed at home. And therefore, locking down societies increases mortality from other causes. We know this is a fact. So you need to look at total mortality. And the way you do this is that you compare mortality year for year before COVID, and then mortality during COVID and after COVID. And then you can look at how much excess mortality was there caused by the virus, total mortality. And when you do that, it turns out that Sweden is one of the best countries in the world with the lowest excess mortality. So they received a lot of blame in the beginning of the pandemic. And now we know, don't ever lock down our societies again. But believe me, we will see this again if a new pandemic comes up, partly because the politicians in many countries, they use experts who know too little about things. This is very strange. They don't use the most qualified experts, but they did that in Sweden.
Okay, if we're going to learn from that experience, what's the prescription that we should be following?
We should do like they did in Sweden. And then, of course,
No masks, no hard lockdowns.
well, yeah, we can say the obvious. No masks. Recently, there was a baby that was killed because he was forced to have a mask in South Korea. And he cried and he had a cold, and then he was suffocated to death. A little child. Of course, we should not demand masks because the randomized trials show pretty clearly that they don't work. And we should not lock down our societies. We should do like Sweden, copy their example.
Could you talk to me a little bit about masks? Could you explain to me why don't they work? For the layperson who's just being told what to do, is it effective in any way?
Not as far as I can see. I have studied the randomized trials carefully and the Cochrane review of the randomized trials. And often in medicine, what you think is obvious turns out not to be what you think when you study it in randomized trials. We often get surprised. So I cannot tell you why face masks don't work. They just don't work. And there is a big study from Bangladesh that is the only one that found an effect of face masks. But in this study, villages were randomized to use face masks or not use face masks. And it turned out that those villages that were told to use face masks, they were also better at keeping a distance to other people. And we know that keeping a distance is wonderfully effective. I mean, if you don't meet any other people, you cannot get infected, can you? So, and this This biasing factor is more than enough to explain the little difference there was in using face mask and not using face mask. And the diagnosis of COVID was, it was not a laboratory diagnosis. It was just like what people felt, because this was out in the countryside in villages. So this study is not at all convincing either. So when you add up all the studies, you stand there empty-handed. And we know that face masks, they can cause harms. I told you about this toddler who died, but face masks cause a lot of other harms. For example, it's very important to be able to read other people's faces, to see what is their mood. Are they angry with me or are they friendly? And particularly for children, I mean, the social interaction, it's so important that you can read people's faces, and you can't do that behind a mask. So this is just one of the many harms masks are causing. And then it's funny, I have never met a single person who used a face mask correctly. Not one in the whole world. I mean, what people do is more or less the same as me, that we use the same mask for days or even weeks until it finally breaks. And then we take a new mask. And the rules are that you should change it several times a day. No one does that.
In New Zealand, we had a rule that you had to wear it walking into a restaurant, but once you sat down to eat, you could take it off. It didn't seem very scientific advice to me.
Well, I have a very funny personal experience. When we were on holiday in Southern Europe, in Greece, I think it was, my wife and I wanted to have dinner at a German restaurant. So I went in there and it was absolutely full, and everybody was sitting as close as they could to each other without face masks. And then I went in and I wanted to order a table for the next day since it was full. So I needed to go up to the waiter. And when I came up there, she said, "You have to wear a face mask in here." And I pointed to all these people and say, "No one has a face mask." "Oh yeah, but you need to wear one until you are seated," she said. And I said, "But I'm leaving now. I just need to make an appointment for tomorrow." And then an old German guy came out from the toilet and he looked at me like if I was Satan. He said, I'm afraid you're standing there without a face mask. Please leave." And I thought, these people are mad. So, and the waitress got annoyed with me and said, "I don't want you in here tomorrow." And I said, "Great, I don't want to come here tomorrow."
It seems like there were two viruses. There was a mind virus as well.
Oh, it was so crazy in all sorts of ways. In Denmark, you were allowed to walk on a golf course, but if you played golf, you must wear a face mask. But if you are just strolling with your dog, you should not wear a face mask. I mean, it was so illogical, many of these rules. I have another funny experience. One of my good friends from America, she was walking on the beach early one morning in California. She was the only person on the whole beach until a cop came by and said, "You need to wear a face mask here." And she said, "I'm totally alone." He didn't care.
Yeah. It seemed to envelop the whole world, and it was maddening. Another thing that I found maddening was part of the COVID-19 experience all over the world was this constant emphasis on cases. We kept hearing about case numbers on a daily basis, and that was all based on the PCR testing that was done. And I'd love to know your opinion. Was that a normal reaction to a pandemic, to test everybody constantly? And then secondly, was the PCR test fit for purpose? Because one of the things I heard about that was that the PCR test is not supposed to be used to diagnose anything. But all those case numbers that we're talking about, that's what the whole pandemic was based on. These huge numbers all around the world. We've got to do something. The numbers are rising all of the time. And that PCR test appeared to me as it was that it was providing that emphasis.
The testing madness is also worth discussing because this was not evidence-based. And the PCR test, even though it's pretty accurate, when you use it as a screening test, I mean, people were recommended to be tested again and again and again, even though they were healthy. And when you use an accurate test on people who are healthy, you start getting into trouble. I received an early version of a manuscript from a good virus researcher who had the idea that the virus did not originate from Wuhan, but in America, because there was a study where they had tested a lot of Americans with this PCR test. And then they had found, let's say, around 2% of them that the test was positive. So she reasoned that maybe the disease originated in America. Then I wrote back to her. I did some calculations. And then I said, what was found in this study is exactly what you would expect to find when it's all false, because the test is not 100% accurate. So this study doesn't tell us anything at all. Just forget about it.
So then I've got another question along those lines, is what is the verdict now? How deadly is COVID?
John Ioannidis at Stanford University is one of my friends. He published a lot of articles in the beginning of the pandemic and also subsequently. And he suffered very badly from being an honest scientist. So John and I looked at the issues independently from one another, and we came to the same conclusion early on in the pandemic that the virus as such is not incredibly dangerous. It's not more dangerous than many of the influenza viruses that we have had. But the reason that so many people died has to do with lack of immunity in the community. Then any virus can be much deadlier than if people are semi-immune because they have been infected by similar viruses earlier. And in one of my books, I have given the example from the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic. They had not had measles for a lifetime, so the population was not semi-immune or immune against measles. Then measles came to the Faroe Islands, and the death rate was 10 times higher than it usually is in Denmark, for example. So there you have a brilliant example of how deadly a virus can be if you have absolutely no immunity in the population. And I believe this is the major reason why so many people died from COVID-19.
But one of the other things that I remember from it was very early on, we had the case of the Diamond Princess cruise ship. And that showed us very early on that it really was a virus that only attacked the people with the comorbidities, the people largely at risk. Is that not a point to be made here as well?
Oh, yes. And John Ioannidis wrote an article about the experience from this cruise ship early on. But as I said, he became very unpopular because everybody wanted to show a picture that was different from what John and I tried to tell people.
Why do you think that was? How did the world get captured by that narrative?
Oh, that's easy. When people feel threatened, they panic. And even scientists panicked. And sorry for the expression, they lost their heads, many of them. They didn't behave as logically as they would normally do. They were somehow captured by the dangerousness of the whole thing.
Okay, to finish up, I'd like to ask you, what has science learnt from all of this? Do you think this is going to happen again? Or have we gone through something which we just needed to go through and we've all learnt the lessons and we can get on with life now?
Unfortunately, it seems that the authorities have not learned much, and authorities are not keen to admit their mistakes. So somehow they often repeat their mistakes in order not to lose face. So I would say that when the next pandemic comes around, unfortunately, I think the authorities will be equally unreasonable as they were during this pandemic.
Peter, thank you so much for your time. In this day and age when censorship is so pervasive, and these days when science appears to be at a crossroads, we need voices like yours more and more. And I know it takes a lot of bravery to keep speaking up, but it's also so important because if we learn nothing from all we've been through, it will literally have been for nothing. So we appreciate you very much. Thanks for joining us and thanks for your time. And I hope we can speak again in the future.
Thank you, Alistair.
That's Peter Gercher, one of the biggest names in the world of medical research, speaking to us today about his views and research on what really happened globally during the COVID pandemic. And if you want to hear more from Peter, please visit his Broken Medical Science website at brokenmedics.com. As we just heard from Peter, it is overwhelmingly more likely than not now that COVID did come from a lab, and that lockdowns and masking did more damage than good. But it's the lab leak story that is most bewildering, because as you just heard Peter tell us, the COVID lab leak that has caused millions of deaths is not the first time it has happened. In fact, you can go all the way back to 1977, when the H1N1 virus was also lab leaked and caused over 700,000 deaths. So why is the manipulation of viruses and gain-of-function research still allowed? Why don't our governments simply make that dangerous activity illegal, instead of telling us to use masks that don't work and forcing us into lockdowns that destroy society? How this isn't the biggest scandal in history is still not clear. My name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to another edition of the Inquiry Sessions on Reality Check Radio.
The RCR Inquiry Sessions. Unpacking the COVID response for an honest inquiry.